We are going to begin the January 18th, 2023 meeting of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District. We always start our meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. Can I ask our Vice President, Director Corona, to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Ready to begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I ask the Board Secretary to read the instructions for virtual meeting attendance and then call the roll of the Board.
Yes. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the Board can hear you when you are speaking. Now we will do roll call. President Pauly?
Here.
Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
Director Record is absent, and our legal counsel is present.
Very good. Thank you very much. April, do we have anyone wishing to do public comment on any items not on the agenda this morning?
I don't have any requests.
We do not. Very good. With that, we will move to item 2 on our agenda, which is the executive reports. Mr. Mawad.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the Board. My report is included in your packet. Under new and ongoing items, we are closely monitoring the evolving hydrology up north as well as along the Colorado River Basin. As you're aware, precipitation around the state this year has been phenomenal, with the overall statewide snowpack at 226% of normal and the upper Colorado River Basin at 149% of normal for this time of year. While precipitation has been favorable, water system storage continues to be dismal, with Lake Powell and Lake Mead at 23% and 28% of capacity, respectively. Lake Orville is filling up quickly, though, and as of this morning, it's around 58% of capacity, and Shasta Lake is currently at 53% of capacity. The Department of Water Resources maintains the State Water Project Allocation Table A at 5%, and Metropolitan has initiated discussions regarding moving forward with a region-wide allocation potentially effective this summer. So we will continue to be engaged with Metropolitan, and we will continue to report and update the Board accordingly on the evolving conditions. The next item is I wanted you to be aware that last week, President Pauly, myself, and staff had an opportunity to meet with the staff from IE Works. IE Works provides regional agencies like us, community-based organizations to establish internships and pre-apprenticeship programs that aim to prepare young adults from underrepresented communities with the skills required to successfully obtain certifications and become water treatment and distribution operators. It was an opportunity for us to provide IE Works with an overview of EMWD, our various programs in terms of workforce engagement, workforce training. And we're very optimistic that this year we'll be able to expand our working relationship with IE Works with potentially an intern within our treatment, wastewater treatment operations. Next item, I wanted to update you that on January 10th, staff held the final financial agreement notary signing event for the Murrieta residents of the Los Alamos Hills community. This event has been coordinated and scheduled to provide the residents of the community with an opportunity to easily sign up and commit to annexation of their properties into our service area for future connection for potable water service. And to date, as shown here in the exhibit, we have 36 properties that have signed agreements indicating their interest to be part of the annexation that we are about to embark on. So staff is going to be working to prepare the necessary legal plats and maps for submittal to LAFCO as well as Metropolitan Water District. And I do want to give a shout out to our public government affairs. We've secured 36 properties out of the 50 It's a really a great response from the community. And as we've indicated in the past, this is strictly voluntary. This is an opportunity for us to streamline the process of annexation to those interested property owners. So we're going to be moving forward with preparation of the necessary applications. Yes, Director Armstrong.
Was there a minimum threshold of parcels that needed to agree to participate for us to move forward with this?
Originally, we were thinking that 75% of the 50 parcels, but through the process of engaging the community, it became apparent that some property owners, for various reasons, perhaps because of the size and the annexation fees, simply are not interested. Others were not responsive. We have about 7 properties that we can't get hold of. So our recommendation to this board is that we simply move forward with those properties that want to be part of this. As we mentioned before, we don't necessarily feel this is obligatory. This is strictly voluntary. So our recommendation is the 36 properties, and there are some additional ones that do come in over the next couple of weeks as we prepare the LAFCO application. Of course, we'll accept those as well. But our recommendation is simply move forward with those that want to be part of it.
Got it. Thanks.
Next item, the recycled water status. So, obviously, with the heavy rains that we've experienced over the last couple of weeks, that has led to significantly lower demands on our recycled water sales. And as such, we're currently at 80% of storage capacity. So last week, I authorized implementation of the discounted winter rates to help minimize the amount of recycled water that we would have to discharge. That discounted rate is available to our agricultural customers, as well as to Rancho California Water District, which we contacted. That rate will be in effect from January 13th to the end of March of this year. Now, having said that, we have commenced recycled water discharge as of this morning, and we anticipate doing so for the next couple of weeks. We will fill up our storage to 90%, reserve that remaining 10% of capacity in case there's a outage on our discharge pipeline or any other type of emergency that we have to respond to. But we anticipate, given the amount of rainfall, that our recycled water sales will be depressed at least for the next couple of weeks. We'll keep you updated on our efforts accordingly. Under items of interest to the board, there's been a number of key developments at Metropolitan Water District that I wanted to share with the board. As you're aware, on January 9th, Director Armstrong was sworn in as Metropolitan's board member representing EMWD. And on the following day, I had the privilege to introduce him as EMWD's representative at the board of directors. At the same meeting, Chairman Adan Ortega took the oath of office for a two-year term commencing January 1st of this year, and Jacqueline McMillan was inducted as a new board member representing Cayegas Municipal Water District. Also, Director Armstrong was appointed to the One Water and Stewardship Committee and the Finance, Audit, Insurance, and Real Property Committee. Both committees are of significant importance to us and the entire region. We understand that Dr. Armstrong may also be appointed to a number of additional subcommittees and ad hoc committees. I also wanted to mention that at the same January 10th Metropolitan Board meeting, Director Record was awarded his 20-year service pin for his two decades of service and dedication to the Metropolitan Board. Lastly, at the Metropolitan meeting on January 10th, the Board of Directors did award a $59.5 million construction contract to James Fowler Company to construct the Interstate 215 tunnel crossing as a final reach of the Paris Valley Pipeline. This is a significant project that we have advocated for many years, and we are glad to see that Metropolitan is advancing construction of that facility. It's going to provide significant water supply benefits and flexibility for this entire region, not only to EMWD, but also to Western Municipal Water District. Finally, I wanted to mention that last week we had the opportunity to host the AQUA president, Ms. Pam Tobin, as well as AQUA's vice president, Ms. Kathy Green, and AQUA's executive director, Dave Egerton, for a briefing on EMWD. It was a great opportunity to share with them all our different initiatives, including a tour of our recently commissioned Paris to Desalter. We also shared with them our tiered rates approach, our succession planning effort, and our customer service effort, and they were very much engaged. And in fact, they're very interested in our succession planning efforts, as they recently have established an Aqua Foundation that assists their membership in development of workforce and filling those long-term needs for member agencies staffing. With that, be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions for the general manager? Thank you very much for that report. Laura, do you have an item for us this morning?
Nothing this morning.
Very good. Nick?
Good morning. I'm excited to let you know that today we're receiving an award, and to present that to us, we have a small contingent here from Black and Veatch, and I'd like to introduce first Jim Clark, who will be presenting the award to us. And I worked with Jim in past lifetimes, past agencies, and it's a real pleasure to have him here joining us today. But as far as the rest of the team that's here to support Jim, we have Kevin Davis. Kevin, if you just stand up, let them know who you are. Kevin Davis is vice president with Black and Veatch and project director for their water group, and Kevin is very instrumental in supporting us on a number of our critical CIP projects. And Kevin, if you could just do a quick shout out from there as far as the rest of your team that helps support you and everything that you do for us.
Happy to. So this is Dave Cooper. He's one of our project managers, has managed a lot of your projects. Jeff Neiman has done a lot of the technical work on some of your advanced treatment. And Zana Virgil has also done some of the technical work on a lot of your projects.
Thanks, Kevin. So I'd just like to share a few words with regards to Jim Clark, who I'm going to bring up here in a moment. But I just want to let you know that Jim Clark is a registered civil engineer. He's a senior vice president with Black & Veatch and has over 40 years of experience. He's an expert in water and wastewater policy and infrastructure, having led the planning, design, and construction of more than $3 billion in related projects throughout the world, but most prominently here in California. Jim has served in a leadership role in many water and wastewater organizations, most notably as president for the Water Environment Federation, arguably the largest and most prestigious wastewater-focused organization in the world. In addition, Jim was appointed by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences to serve as one of the 9-member international nominating committee for the Stockholm Water Prize, the most prestigious global award for water professionals, considered by many to be the Nobel Prize for water. Jim is here today, as I said, to present an award to EMWD on behalf of several agencies, including the Water Environment Federation, the National Association of Clean Water Agencies, the Water Research Foundation, the U.S. Water Alliance, and Water Reuse. It's a combined agency presentation. And as past president of the Water Environment Federation, Black & Veatch's representative to NACWA, a former member of the Water Research Foundation, a founding board member of the U.S. Water Alliance, and a member of Water Reuse, Jim is the right person to do it. So with that, I'd like to ask Jim to come up and share some more information with you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. It's a pleasure for me to be here. The sponsoring organizations of the Utility of the Future Today program understand that substantial excellence in operations of wastewater treatment systems exists today, and that many utilities optimize and continually improve their operations, consistently meet or exceed their regulatory requirements, plan and effectively the maintenance, repair, and replacement of their infrastructure, and engage their employees and communities in meaningful and productive ways. There are 7 categories of recognition, and a utility can be recognized in each category. In fact, the district was recognized in 2020 in the water reuse category, and again in 2021 in the energy generation and recovery category. And it is my pleasure to represent the Water Environment Federation and the 4 other sponsoring organizations in presenting the 2022 Utility of the Future Today recognition to Eastern Municipal Water District in the partnering and engagement category for innovative and forward-thinking practices that are providing sustainable, efficient, and value-added services to your community. And I also want to offer my personal congratulations for all of the good work that you do, that you've done, and continue to do for our industry. Thank you very much.
Paulie, could we get a photograph with you great, and Joe Mawad?
Matt, why don't you join us for the photo?
Could we also get the full BV team, if that would be okay with you?
Thank you very much. Again, thank you for being here, and a pleasure to accept that award. Lynette, do we have anything this morning?
Good morning, President Pauley. Nothing from me this morning. Thank
you. And Mr. Melendez?
Yeah, good morning. I had a couple quick things. One is Joe is discussing our recycled water demands, just to put some of that into perspective. Already this year, we've had 14.8 inches of rain, and 8.9 inches of those have just been in the last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. Of January. So, yeah, recycled water demands have been pretty low for several weeks now, leading to the discharge today. But on the positive side, with all that rain, as of this morning, we've recharged 563 acre feet from the river over at Grant Street. So this year, recharge operations are going very well, and hopefully that continues. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Any questions for any of the board members on any? All right. Thank you. We will now go to item 4 on our agenda, which is our action calendar. And item A is to adopt a proposed resolution authorizing the 2023 board committee and other assignments, including approval of memberships, agency, and outside organizations' representations.
I
am so sorry.
I moved over the vote.
Dr. Corona. Move the consent calendar. Director Armstrong, second the consent calendar. Cut a roll call vote, please.
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Apologize for that. Aye. So that passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Well, you make a good vice president. Okay, back to the action calendar. Item A, to adopt proposed resolution authorizing the 2023 board committee and other assignments, including approval of memberships, agency, and outside organization representations. Mr. Mawad.
Thank you, President Pauley, members of the board. With Director Armstrong's recent appointment to the Metropolitan Board of Directors, we wanted to propose minor modifications to the committee makeup, and specifically to the O&E committee, whereby Director Armstrong would step down from that committee, and Dr. Corona is proposed to be added to that committee, and to the planning committee, where Dr. Corona would step down from that committee and Dr. Slauson would be added. So the proposed changes are strictly for the O&E committee and the planning committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Any questions?
No.
Like a motion? Moved by Director Corona, second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Item B is to approve updates to the investment policy and adopt a proposed resolution of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District authorizing investment in local agency investment fund. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. First off, I just want to thank the board for entrusting me as the appointed treasurer, as well as our talented finance staff in managing the district's investment portfolio of over $600 million. So as part of management of the portfolio, the California Government Code requires that any change in our investment policy shall be considered by the government body. So our investment policy is a very important document because it communicates to the public our investment guidelines and priorities and the parameters for investing that the board authorized. I'll be handing over the presentation to Tracy Lee, our financial manager, who will provide the overview to the changes to the policy and provide an update of our portfolio. But I'd just like to thank her and our finance team who raised the bar for the district by submitting our policy for certification by CMTA. CMTA is the California Municipal Treasurers Association, and this past year, for the first time, we submitted this for certification. And they confirmed that we comply with California state statutes governing the investment practices of local government. They did have some recommendations for fine-tuning our policy, which are most of what the changes are recommended today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tracy Lee.
Good morning.
Thank you, Laura, and good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. If you recall, we last brought the investment policy to the board in September 2021, where we added supranationals and the Riverside County Treasurer's Pool, along with other comprehensive changes. Since then, staff has submitted the investment policy as approved in September 2021 to the California Municipal Treasurers Association, or CMTA, Investment Certification Program. And in this program, local agency policies are reviewed across 19 different areas of interest and scored. If they receive a score of 85 or higher out of 100 possible points, the investment policy is certified. The team will also provide feedback for recommendation for changes. And as Laura mentioned, on December 1st, 2022, EMWD received CMTA's certification. And with that certification, staff received and incorporated the feedback into a revised investment policy. The proposed investment policy includes the listed minor changes here. To highlight a few, to include the annual delegation of investment authority to the treasurer, reducing risk by decreasing the maximum percentage of commercial paper of a single issuer from 10% to 5%, and the treasurer's report shall be prepared within 45 days following the end of the month and presented at the next public meeting. We have a quick market update for you. You may remember in December 2022, the Federal Reserve increased rates by 50 basis points or half a percentage, and that does follow four prior 75 basis point or three-quarter percentage hikes for a total of 4.25% increase for 2022 as a whole. We've listed some inflation rates there, and as you can see, it is trending downward. December rates were recently released at 6.5%, which continues the trend and confirms investor expectation that the Fed would further slow the pace of monetary tightening. However, the Fed does remain committed to rate hikes as needed to combat inflation. And as just mentioned, we are still pretty high above the 2% target. Through all of this market volatility, EMWD's portfolio strategy does remain the same. Safety is our first priority, followed by liquidity, and finally yield. As of November 2022, our total market value of portfolio was $614 million, with a portfolio yield of 1.48%. That is made up of roughly 50% agency bonds and 15% each of liquidity, municipal bonds, treasuries, and followed by 4% of corporate bonds. The portfolio investment types, percentages, as well as liquidity options are regularly discussed and monitored between our finance team, including our treasurer. Per California Government Code, Section 53607 states, the authority to invest or reinvest funds of a local agency may be delegated for a one-year period by the legislative body to the treasurer of the local agency. And as such, staff is recommending the annual delegation of the investment authority by the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District to our treasurer for 2023. Staff is also recommending the update to our Local Agency Investment Fund, or LAIF, resolution to update staff titles and names as approved by the board in order to authorize withdrawal and deposit into our LAIF account. Our recommendation is to approve the updated 2023 investment policy and adopt proposed resolution by the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District to authorize investment of funds in the Local Agency Investment Fund. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? No, Director Slauson.
Thank you. I think this looks great. Reducing the amount of investment in commercial paper from 10 to 5 is said to reduce risk. Is that based on the current economy, or is it just an overall standard that we should abide by?
It's an overall standard. That was one of the recommendations received by CMTA. As of today, we don't hold any commercial paper, but that would be an option for future investment.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Director Armstrong.
Yeah. I just wanted to compliment the staff for, submitting our investment policy for review to the CMTA. And then also for getting the recognition from it. But I think this is a very sizable portfolio for a district to have, and for us to be this successful managing it internally as we do, it's really important to have those reviews done by, you know, whether it's like a GFOA, you know, a CMT, all of those things. But we participate with those with our financial reports or our budgets, and those are just really good things to participate in. And so I just compliment you on what you've done.
Thank you. It's
a great outcome, so congratulations.
Any other questions? Then I'll look for a motion on this item. Director Armstrong, seconded by Director Slauson. Make it a roll call vote, please.
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crono?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Thank you very much for the presentation. We'll move on to item C, which is to adopt a proposed resolution for Quail Valley Tank 3 project, initial study, mitigated negative declaration and mitigation monitoring and reporting program, and to approve Quail Valley Tank 3 project and authorize preparation and filing of the notice of determination and environmental filing fee. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Joe Broadhead from the Environmental Regulatory Compliance Department. The purpose of the Quail Tank 3 project is to address the storage capacity deficit in pressure zone 1800 of the district's potable water system. The map on the right side of the slide shows the location of the project site, which is located in the city of Menifee, west of the 215, and east of Canyon Lake, and access to the project site is located off of South Canyon Drive that goes up to the existing two tanks that we have at the site. Features of the Quail Tank 3 project is the construction of 1.63 million gallon capacity water storage tank that's designed to approximately 40 feet in height and 101 feet in diameter. A detention basin is also a component of the project, as well as an 18-inch pipeline that will connect the new facilities with the existing district pipelines within South Canyon Drive. The site plan for the project, here you see the existing uses together with the proposed Quail Tank 3 facilities. At the top of the slide is existing Quell Valley tank number one. At the bottom is tank number two, and it's adjacent to tank two that tank three would be constructed. And then downhill from tank two is the proposed detention facility. And then you can also see the replacement pipeline within the access road through South Canyon Drive South that would connect with the existing district pipeline. We prepared two sets of photo simulations, top to bottom. On the left side is a shot from the south side of South Canyon Drive looking back up at the project site. So left top, you see existing Quell Tank 2 poking out above the berm. Left side, middle, is the completion of Quell Tank 3. And then left bottom is 10 years post-construction with vegetation maturity. Moving on to the right side, right top is existing shot further north on South Canyon Drive looking back at the project site. Quell Tank 2 is obscured by an existing tree. Right middle is Quell Tank 3 following construction. And then right bottom is 10 years post-construction with vegetation maturity. The district prepared an initial study to take a look at the potential impacts that would result from the project to determine whether a mitigated NAICS deck or an environmental impact report would be appropriate. And at the conclusion of the analysis, it was identified that five impact areas would require mitigation, and we've identified the mitigation. And the conclusion with the implementation of the mitigation is that all of the impacts would be less than significant, which allows us to move forward with the mitigated NAICS deck for the project. For public review, we consulted with the Pechanga Band of Luseno Indians prior to document release, which is a requirement of Assembly Bill 52. Sent the document out for a 30-day public review period from September 19th to October 20th. And we put the notice of intent in the Press Enterprise prior to the document going out for public review. The NOI was also sent to agencies and residents. It was also sent to the county recorder, which is not listed here, but that's one of the noticing requirements that we complied with. And then the document, electronic version of the document, was put on the EMWD website. Hard copies were put at our administrative offices for anybody that wanted to come in and take a look at hard copy of the document. At the end of the comment period, we received four comment letters, one from State Water Resources Control Board, CDFW, City of Menifee, and the Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians. Of note for the comment letter, CDFW did provide comments that resulted in modifications to the biomitigation measures, and we've noted those changes and underlying strikeout within the final initial study mitigated NAICS deck, which is part of the board packet. All of the comments and responses are also included in the final initial study mitigated NAICS deck, which is part of the board packet. Staff recommendation is to adopt the proposed resolution for Quell Valley 3 Project Initial Study Mitigated NAICS deck and Mitigation Monitoring and Reporting Program, and approve the Quell Valley Tank 3 project, and then authorize staff to prepare and file the Notice of Determination and pay the environmental filing fees for the project. And with that, that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
Director Slauson.
I just have one question. We saw this in Option Engineering. On the cultural monitoring, has one tribe agreed to do the monitoring?
At this point, we haven't selected that tribe, but typically we take a look at the region where the project's located, and it tends to be within our district, the Luseno tribes. So for this project, it would most likely be the Pechanga tribe, since they consulted with us, and it tends to be in that area.
Okay.
But to your point, Director Slauson, usually there's just one representative for the tribes to do the cultural monitoring. Is that correct, Joe?
That's correct.
I've been talking to some planners in Moreno Valley where the tribes are sometimes in conflict and have sort of argued and said, well, we should both be there then. And they have to work with them and talk with them, but obviously you got it down, so thank you.
Any other questions? I'll look for a motion on this item.
I'll move it.
Moved by Director Slauson, second by Director Corona. May I go to roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-2-0 with Director Record absent. Thank you very much for a great presentation. We will go on now to item D, which is to approve and authorize with CPS HR Consulting for $184,000 for the succession planning and workforce development consulting services. Laura.
Good morning again. So last August, HR Director Joe Opris and I brought to this board an informational item regarding succession planning and workforce development. And within that report, we provided data highlighting that we had 34 retirements in 2021 and anticipated 13 retirements this past year in 2021, which ultimately resulted in 25. And analysis showed that another 135 retirements were going to happen through 2035. So this is a problem all governments are experiencing right now. And through our strategic priorities, we were tasked by the board to ensure we have programs and procedures in place to prepare our future workforce to fill important vacancies as needed. In the August presentation to the board, policy principles were outlined to guide the priority. The principles were: implement a succession planning program that ensures business continuity without interruption, preserve and expand institutional knowledge, invest in staff development to provide leadership and growth opportunities, develop a program that provides feedback to the community, feedback to continuous evaluate succession planning efforts, and commitment by the organization's leaders to actively implement succession planning efforts. So we also went over many of the initiatives that the district is currently doing to prepare employees, which was extensive. But we noted that we needed to incorporate what we were doing now with other best practices in order to create a comprehensive succession and workforce development program for the district. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Joe Opris, who will overview our recommendations for a short-term and longer-term plan, which will include assistance by a firm, CPSHR, who are present here today, and he'll introduce them. They work solely with government agencies and specialize in the area of succession planning and workforce development. So with that, I'll turn it over to Joe Opris.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Thank you for allowing us to be here this morning to speak on this topic. This is, as Laura mentioned, we brought up recently this past fall, and we kind of want to jump into some short-term strategy and long-term strategy of what's going to happen. We're looking to partner with CPSHR Consulting, and it's going to be part of the longer-term strategy. So we still got to focus on what's going to happen this coming year. So that's going to be our short-term strategy. We want to address the anticipated retirements within this next year. We all know with the recent cost of living adjustment, we anticipate that many employees will and have already deferred retirement from this past year at the end of this year, and then will most likely retire late into this year, 2023, and most likely early into 2024 as well. So some of the numbers will increase based off of that. So with that, there needs to be a plan in place, because our long-term strategy, partnering with CPSHR Consulting, we'll take a little bit of time, and as we go through this presentation, we have outlined, you know, their process of evaluation and partnering with us to form a official plan will take about a year. So we need to focus on some short-term strategies. So with that, we have evaluated a few different firms, and we would like to propose to move forward with a CPS HR Consulting. So short-term strategy approach at this point, we're going to focus really internally. We want to review org charts with a senior team, discuss possible and upcoming key management operational staff retirements, and whether internal talent exists and how we can move those internal folks into those key positions. So we're going to be sitting down. We've already started the process as we're going through the budget process to look at vacancies, to look at the different positions that might be vacant. So this is already in the works. We also want to determine the knowledge transfer and training needs that need to occur once we determine which positions are currently vacant and we'll be recruiting for or will become vacant through retirements. Now, if we don't find anything internal, we will look at external focus as well, focus on recruitments there. So in the past 6 months, we've actually made already some adjustments as we want to focus on those recruitments as well. Before, we had only a contract with one external recruiter when it came to needing additional help. Now we have a contract with three, and those are used as needed. And then we also have changed the structure in HR in our department as well, where before we only had one HR tech focusing on recruitment, and now we have two just because of the need of wanting to fill those positions. There's also additional efforts if we need to look at bringing in temp workers or whatnot, but we're not there yet. So for both internal and external, we will be working with the hiring managers to initiate recruitments as early as possible to ensure timely replacement. So that's the short term, and short term is kind of something that constantly is going to happen internally. Even with this succession plan coming in place, it's something that we're always trying to focus on. Our long-term strategy is to partner with CPSHR Consulting. CPSHR Consulting provides a full range of HR solutions beyond just succession planning. So they're very knowledgeable, and they work with state, local governments, public safety, special district, nonprofit organizations as well. So they will help us to really ensure business continuity by preparing our talent, resources, as change occurs in our organization through retirements and whatnot. So a succession plan built by CPS and EMWD will also reflect what our strategic goals are, what our plans are, and what our vision and what our mission is. So the scope of work includes an assessment and analysis of our current state. It determines gaps, forms best practices for us, provides recommendations, will incorporate DEI initiatives while developing our succession plan and a workforce development plan. So just a brief view of kind of what our plan we'll look at, and I'm not going to jump into the weeds of everything, get into HR terminology, but I want to kind of go into kind of explain what CPS is going to be doing for us. They're really going to come and evaluate our career paths, evaluate what's going on here at EMWD, give us the time and the hours to be able and the resources to be able to do that. To really, when we have employees coming into our organization and they have a desire and a passion to move up, to move forward, to really, somebody comes in and says, I want to be a deputy GM, or I want to be a GM, I want to be a director, I want to be a manager. We're going to find them that pathway, and it's going to be an official pathway for them to be able to, when that need is there and called upon, for them to be able to find that way in there. Our job descriptions have, minimum qualifications and requirements and different things, and we want to be sure that we're able to develop our employees to get to that spot where they can reach those desires and goals when there's a need in the organization. So we're really, CPS is partnering with us to put that plan together and make it something that employees can tangibly go through and achieve that goal of reaching that position. So this is what really the five-step process is going to look like once we get through the whole process, but which is going to be a lot more just doing the analyzing of everything that we have and preparing and communication and all that. But step one is going to be for us to identify key positions. Step two is to identify participants, who are the individuals who have these desires and want to develop themselves and grow. Step three is going to be preparing the participants. So what are the different steps that we're going to need to take to get them to meet these qualifications for these next level positions? And step four is going to be actually the development. So what needs to happen? How are we going to get them through that? How are we going to, what training needs to be done? What education needs to be done? And step five is going to be monitoring the process and recognizing the achievement. So through this whole thing, if there's no accountability, if no one's checking in, if no one is, you know, monitoring the progress, really at the end of the day, we're going to go through these steps for no reason. So I'm not going to jump into this too much, but I wanted to put this up here because this is the project scope and timeline to show that there's going to be four different phases, and it's going to take about 56 or so weeks. We're hoping to crunch it in and make it shorter. But there's going to be so many different parts of this that really are going to be required to do to get us to actually be in place to where we're going to be up here and, you know, provide updates as we go along. But at the end of this whole process, we'll be able to say, we have a plan in place. Here's a plan. Here's what it looks like. Here's what employees can go through to, you know, achieve that spot. And for us to know that we have, we're filling those gaps when we have those retirements and we have those vacancies and we know we have a pool of people that can, you know, meet these positions. So we're not, you know, in a place where we're not providing services as needed. And this, again, I'm not going to jump into too much, but this also shows just the amount of hours and time that it takes to do each of these phases and how the costs are associated with each. But it takes a lot of hours to complete a lot of these different things. And for us to be able to partner with a consultant to give us those resources is really a helpful thing, in my opinion, as the director of the HR department, that I don't need to really give the resources of individuals who are already, you know, working full-time jobs to be able to do this as well. So the project outcomes, the succession planning, workforce development plan, and recommendations by CPS will set the framework for additional investment that may be required to implement the plan. So there might be different things as recommendations from CPS that we might need to look into to provide funding for, but that's something that we would provide updates to this board on a regular basis if anything comes up in the process itself that would you know, enhance our employees and bring them to the place where they need to be for the next level positions. Project activities will include assessment of EMWD's DEI efforts for recruitment and other workforce initiatives as well. And then we will be providing periodic project updates to the board, management, and union leadership as well. So the recommendation is to approve and authorize the general manager or his designee to execute an agreement with CPS HR Consulting in the amount not to exceed $184,500 for succession planning and workforce development consulting services. And with that, I do want to introduce, we have Jeff back here from CPS HR Consulting.
Jeff, why don't you come forward and introduce your firm a little to the board?
Thank you, President Pauly. Good to see you again, directors. CPS HR Consulting, we're actually a joint powers authority here in the state of California, legislated in almost 30 years ago. CPS, as has already been shared with you, we work with governmental agencies from the federal space all the way down to local government, also special districts like yourselves and nonprofit. What's nice, if I could brag on CPS a bit, what's nice about CPS HR Consulting, we're not a for-profit firm. Our board is made up of local government HR leaders. So we get pounded on thought leadership, not what we're bringing to the bottom line for stockholders and bonuses and whatnot. And so work like this is something that's near and dear to our hearts. We also ourselves have our own succession planning program, which is we sometimes affectionately refer to it as the leadership pipeline. So we're in the pipeline business too, and it's a proactive, mindful act, and it's what we consider to be a key part of business continuity, and we think it's the responsibility of the board and leadership of an organization to take care with the development and maintenance of key leaders within an organization. I run our organizational strategy area. Within that area, we also, in my portfolio, have the Institute for Public Sector Employee Engagement, as well as our DEI program, which we run nationally as well. I will stop with that response, but welcome any questions or comments on the board's part?
questions or comments on this?
So I just had one, and I'll ask you. So you're going to do a year's worth of good work for us, and after that year, what happens next? Do we get a nice report that sits on a shelf, or how do we implement all the recommendations that you make?
So what you'll have on the back end, from your standpoint, you and general manager and key staff will have an ability to look at where are you in terms of key positions, both leadership and technical, in terms of gaps and how well are we taking care with making sure we have continuity in these key positions. So you'll have a way to mindfully look at that. You'll also get out of the replacement planning trap that we all find ourselves in. It's like, uh-oh, so-and-so is leaving. We better hurry up and get after that. This is really more of a 3 to 4 year runway. And so our job is to leave Joe with HR, as he said, and Laura and staff the ability to continue to carry out and operationalize what we leave behind. The other key part of it is to make sure that it's linked with strategic and operational plans. So as you course navigate into the future, the workforce plan and succession plan should also adapt in agile ways. The key competencies in the future for a general manager and other key staff, they might change, and so it's good to get ahead of that to make sure that we're developing and having folks ready for the future. So to your specific question, our job is to make sure that you all can operationalize and maintain and DIY for many years to come.
All right. Very good. Well, I appreciate you being here today. Appreciate the presentation.
Thank you.
I just want to say I do believe this is a very important step we're taking here. And I don't know if the general manager wants to make any comments on it, but as sure. we go forward and the workforce changes, I think this is vital to our organization.
No, I agree, President Pauly, and I know I've just discussed this topic with the board in the past, but we see this as a challenge not only for us, but frankly for the entire industry. And this step is to better prepare us to meet that challenge. To answer your earlier question, what we are looking to achieve out of this initiative is a programmatic approach, whereby we're able to continue to recruit the best talent in our industry and then retain that talent and grow that talent and make sure that our mission continues uninterrupted as we go through what we anticipate to be significant retirements over the next couple of years. That is our objective. That's my objective, is to make sure we have a comprehensive programmatic approach to meeting this challenge.
Very good. Director Armstrong.
Yes. Well, I agree. This is, I think, absolutely critical to have the succession plan in place. And I agree with President Pauly, it shouldn't be something that just sits on the shelf. And I think that's why we need someone with experience and expertise to come in and make sure that we do have a plan that will function for us and help us. And so I think it's great that you found a good partner to do that.
I think the other thing to note is, aside from a document that provides the gap analysis and their recommendations, they're also going to help us with a communication plan so that we can work with April's group and communicate what the outcome is and where we're headed. So they'll be helping us with that. And I really see this kind of, as he mentioned, incorporating this into the strategic planning we do and the strategic priorities. So whatever the recommendations that are made, we'll prioritize them and include them as strategic priorities in our triennial.
Very good. And as when this is complete, I trust you'll come back before the board and give us a full presentation of what we got.
So, in between then, too, we'll provide updates and status on the process.
Very good. I will look for a motion on this item. If there's no more questions, Director Armstrong, second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. I look forward to a future report on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will move on to informational items. Why don't we do the Help to Others program and then perhaps take, Laura, maybe a 5-minute break, because cost of service is going to be what, about an hour?
Yes.
Okay. Let's do the Help to Others and then we'll take a short break before cost of service.
Great. And President Pauly, Jolene Walsh, who's online, will be providing the presentation. Jolene?
Good morning,
Good morning,
President Pauly and members of the board. Thank you for the opportunity to present updates to the Help to Others low-income assistance program this morning. Next slide, please. To start, this is a really phenomenal partnership between customer service and public affairs, as well as our third-party provider, United Way. It's just been such a success. But as you recall, the board approved launching this program in July of 2020, and that was EMWD's first ever low-income assistance program. And the initial budget was $150,000 to fund the first year of the program for both the assistance amount to customers as well as the funds for the third-party provider. Of course, the program only uses non-rate revenue. We moved forward and executed an MOU with United Way, and the process is such that EMWD customer service advisors will refer delinquent customers to United Way, and then the customers work with United Way to complete the application. United Way then determines eligibility, and that communication comes back to EMWD, where we apply a credit to the customer bill upon eligibility. Next slide, please. So as the program was established, the customers receive a bill credit of $100, as well as late fees and reconnection fees are waived for the month that the credit is provided. And that assistance amount is made available to eligible customers one time in a 12-month period. We found that that $100 wasn't enough, so we did come back to the board and requested a $200 assistance amount, and we have found that the $200 is about the right amount. That is about the amount of 2 months of an average water bill, and we found that that amount is adequate to help customers get caught up so they can then stay current on future bills. Next slide, please. In terms of customer eligibility, the initial requirements, there's a lot of kind of nuts and bolts that the EMWD bill must be in the name of the customer who's seeking the assistance, and the address, it must be the primary residence, and the program's limited to residential customers, and the initial program required that customers not exceed their water budget with the intention of not subsidizing excessive water use. The customer must be delinquent on their bill, and they must go through United Way for the processing. And then we do have income eligibility threshold that is below 200% of the U.S. poverty guidelines. So for a family of four, that's about $50,000. In 2021, we did waive the criteria that customers must be within budget because customers who were truly in need were not getting the assistance. And thanks to the input we received from President Pauly at the Board Admin Committee, we will be proposing going forward that if customers who receive this benefit are also over their water budget, receiving a home audit, it will be a condition for them to receive the benefit. We definitely want to do what we can to help those customers reduce their water use and hence their future water bills going into the future. Next slide, please. Our partnership with United Way has been very successful. You know, United Way is set up for the sole purpose of providing assistance to our communities in all different ways. And United Way started by charging us an extremely nominal fee of $50 per year, plus $5 per transaction, and even though we doubled the assistance amount, the the amount we paid them continued to be $5. They, you know, they do a lot of work for us. They process the applications. They screen for eligibility. They have kind of in-depth conversations with some of the customers to define that eligibility. They manage an online portal. They also accept donations for EMWD's assistance program. If anybody would like to make a donation, we have a place for that now. And then they provide a monthly invoice to Eastern of all the transactions. And United Way has been now doing this since the summer of 2020 and has done the statistics for managing our program. And they find that it takes about an hour of their staff time to receive the application, work with the customer, and do all the paperwork necessary. And an hour of their staff time is, they pay their employees about $20 an hour. So they found that helping us was a money loser for them. So that's one of the program refinements that we want to address today. Next slide, please. So wanted to provide an overall summary of the program activity to date. Well, as of about a month ago when we finalized this presentation, we had assisted 1,068 customers and had utilized $154,000. We continue to receive requests from customers at about the range of 20 to 40 customers per month, so we still have very consistent demand for the program. As I mentioned, we started with a budget of $150,000, and then we received an infusion from the California Water and Wastewater Arrearage Payment Program, or CWAP, as part of the federal COVID funding that trickled down through California of just over $48,000, and now we have a balance of about $44,000 in that account. So we'll be looking to replenish that. Next slide, please. And the last slide is just a summary of the proposed program refinements that we would like to make. We did find through the first couple of years of the program that an assistance amount of about 2 months of the average water bill is about the right amount to really help customers get caught up. So what we would like to do is continue to gradually increase that amount with each EMWD rate increase, just so we stay on track for that assistance amount. As I mentioned earlier, we will provide a follow-up call and make a home audit a condition of receiving the benefit for any of those customers who are over their water budget. We'll do all we can to help them reduce their water bill. And then we'd like to increase United Way's fee to 20% of the credits the customers are receiving. So since we're now providing customers with $200 bill credit, we would pay pay United Way $20 per applicant, and that fee would also slowly increase as the customer assistance amount increased. And then we would also like to budget for this program through the biennial budget process, and of course through that continue to use only non-rate revenue. And that wraps up the updates and proposed refinements to the program that I have. But if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Any questions on this item? No, I think it's a great program that we do here. The one thing I want to always do is make sure in Sacramento we highlight that we do provide these programs for customers that need them, so that the legislators understand that we do come up with creative solutions for those that need help with their water bill, but the system only works when everybody is contributing into the system. So that great presentation, Julian, I appreciate it. With that, why don't we
Thank
take
you.
A, about a 10-minute break before we do the cost of service study. All right. We will readjourn.
I'm ready.
We are at informational item B, which is 2023 cost of service and rate analysis study session 3. Mr. Adams, the floor is yours.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. Today's informational item is our third presentation to the board on our 2023 cost of service study. This study will cover water and sewer rates for 2024. As you recall, this process had started back April with our first presentation to the board in June. So today, we're going to give you an update on our progress and cover the preliminary methodologies that are being used for both water and sewer. Just to note, this doesn't include recycled water. As the board recalls, we did do a comprehensive rate study and market analysis on recycled water last summer. Those rates will be incorporated within the study and will be presented to the board in April for noticing that will be approved in June. So with that, I'm going to go to the next slide. And I should note for the board, we actually have Mark Panny from Corello Engineering on today remotely. He would love to be here in person, but he is expecting his first child hopefully in the next week or two and did not want to, you know, be traveling during that period of time. So we're going to have him.
Fully understandable.
Yeah. Also joining us is our outside special rate consultant, Michael Colantuno, who will be here for answer any questions and provide feedback as we go through the presentation. So the presentation today is going to cover water, talk about the methodology for allocation of cost, our tiered rate approach, and then preliminary results. I do want to highlight the preliminary results are based on the current 2023 budget with certain assumptions on inflation. As we are starting the budget process and already a month into that budget process, as we get updated numbers on budget in February, those numbers will be incorporated in the model. And then as we come back to you in March, you will see updated results for both water and sewer. And then next, we'll cover sewer, talk about the methodology there, have a further discussion about the postage stamp rate that we're proposing, or at least doing the analysis and would like to recommend to the board, and then talk about the preliminary rates. And then, of course, final, just go over the next steps and then be available for any questions. As we go through the presentation, if the board has questions, please, if you have questions, like to ask them, you know, please do so, and then we can have a discussion. We want to make this more of a conversation, make sure that we provide the information that the board wants in order to move forward on the process. So with that, Mark, are you on the line, and would you like to take over?
I am. Just the video functionality is disabled. So I can turn my camera on, but I can't actually turn it on at the moment, so...
No camera needed, as long as you can see the PowerPoint,
we'll get started.
And I will move the presentation forward as you go through it.
Okay, sounds great. Well, thank you, directors, and as John said, I appreciate the flexibility to do this presentation remotely. Last thing I want is my wife yelling at me to hurry to the hospital, so I do appreciate the flexibility. So I think John provided a pretty good introduction as to our goal today, but just to recap, we want to walk you through the methodology that we've developed to put together these updated cost of service-based rates for both water and sewer service, and then second, get your feedback on that process. That's our goal today. And on that note, just highlighting what's on the right there, nothing really is set in stone yet. This is still preliminary. And just want to emphasize that, you know, we've made a best effort at developing this projection based on a projection for 2023-24, but the district is, of course, going through the budget process over the next couple months, and we will be going alongside that process in tandem updating our model. So on that note, the rates presented today, they do represent the directional changes we're seeing. I think they're a good representation of the scale of changes that we would probably bring forward with recommendations, but they have not been finalized to meet the financial goals and policies based on that budget cycle. So it is really to illustrate the methodology at this point. Things still might might change, but we do feel pretty confident about this cost of service methodology and want to focus on that today. Just a brief note, and Michael can jump in if he has anything to add, but the water and sewer rates are subject to California Proposition 218, as I believe you're familiar with. That Proposition 218 requires that rates and charges do not exceed the proportional cost of service to provide those services to customers. We will be using and have been using a combination of case law and precedents with Michael's direction as outside counsel, as well as our understanding of industry best practices to develop those cost of service-based rates, and really to build the closest nexus between the cost that you, the district, incur and the rates that you charge customers. We want those two things to be as closely linked as possible for meeting Prop 218. There are also some procedural requirements that essentially stipulate the noticing and protest process that we'll also be abiding by as well. Let's start with water. And I wanted to lead off with an overview of the water cost allocation results. And somewhat unsurprisingly, the source of supply is the largest cost that the district incurs, is actually developing, purchasing, and treating the various sources of supply that are delivered to customers. That is just over half of all the costs in the water budget that we identified. And I want to highlight that we have already grouped in this figure the different categories to ultimately what class of rate they're going to be collected via. So the blue is the fixed charge, the daily service charge, the capital charge, and then the green is the commodity rate. So after we... after source of supply, about 13% of the costs are related to broadly defined as infrastructure, so the distribution system, the reservoirs, energy for the pump stations, things like that. And then 3% of the costs, which is recovered on the commodity rate, is the conservation component, so the various programs that the district has for customers to use water more efficiently. On the fixed charge, we have a couple different categories there. We have meter and capacity services, essentially maintaining that capacity and the meter for each connection. Capital reliability, that is that charge that is part of the fixed charge to build R&R funding. And then lastly, customer service, so billing, the billing system for metering, things like that. I just want to talk about the conceptual approach, and we're really taking what could be described as a layered tier approach for the tiered rates, and that really helps us build a cost of service foundation for both the tiered and the non-tiered. That even though it's the tiers have that layer approach, we are applying a similar framework to non-tiered as well, where each unit of water sold can really be broken up into four different components. That source of supply, that's where each tier, each unit of water sold has a specific share of the district's supply portfolio. Then we have base capacity. Every unit of water sold benefits from base capacity. That's the, you know, building the system to meet just an average level of demand throughout the year. And then we have peak capacity. I'll talk a little bit more about how we delineate those two in a moment, but some units of water, as you really get into higher volumes of usage, they benefit from those extra, from that extra capacity that's built to meet peak demand periods. And then the last component is the conservation. So because, you know, that peak usage really requires the district to steward those resources. And so the conservation budget is incorporated as a layer in that as well. And we've presented this figure previously, but we made some updates. The primary update is, and I'll talk about the background on this in a second, but that we've finalized our recommendation for the local supplies to have the Tier 1 supply portfolio to be local groundwater and Paris 2 desalter water. Paris 1 and Menifee water will join the water from the water filtration plants and untreated Met water purchases, as well as some portion of Met Tier 1 water as the Tier 2 supply. And then Tiers 3 and 4 is strictly treated Met water purchases. Facilities and distribution, that really gets to that base component I was talking about. Every unit of water sold is benefiting from those. And then when we get to storage and pumping, because we need to build reservoirs and pump stations to maintain system pressure, maintain that on-demand supply in higher volume periods, that gets allocated on a weighted basis. And lastly, conservation, we have reserved for Tiers 3 and 4. I want to talk in depth about the supply component now. So on Tier 1, we've talked about this a little bit previously, but I wanted to talk about this more. So right now, and this is a result of the last cost of service study, groundwater is allocated to meet all of the Tier 1 usage, set at 20% of the household budget. When we developed the cost of service last time, the available groundwater was projected to meet about 20% of all budgeted household allocations. Due to system growth and various changes in those projections, or from those projections, that number is actually closer to about 14%. So there's a gap between what we had projected at 20% and at 14%. We are recommending that Tier 1 now be blended with both groundwater and Paris 2 desalter water to mitigate that challenge. The benefit of this is that we can maintain that 20% threshold and continue to provide the lower cost supplies to Tier 1 customers. The downside of that is, you know, Paris 2 desalter water is still more expensive than groundwater alone, and so the Tier 1 rate would increase to offset that expansion.
Can I?
Yes.
Can I ask a question back
yes.
on that slide?
Director Armstrong. Yes.
No, I'm just for my own understanding, our Tier 1 usage is set at 20% of the household budget. So that is their indoor and outdoor budgets together, and then we take 20% of it and we say that's Tier 1.
That is correct.
And I'm just curious, like, why? How is that determined to set? Why? What's the rationale for setting it that way versus like using indoor budgets for Tier 1 or?
Yeah, Mark, this was a change in the last cost of service study.
Yes, it was.
Mark, why don't you expand on the rationale at that time?
Sure. As John pointed out, prior to 2018, the rate structure did take that exact form that you described, Director Armstrong, where Tier 1 was indoor, Tier 2 was outdoor. Because we wanted a very close link between the supply cost and the tiered rate, so we decided to keep the budgets, right, the indoor plus outdoor, but then tie that Tier 1 amount to what was available as supply. And when we calculated what was projected to be produced from groundwater and projected for household budgets, it was about 20%. And so we felt that was a strong cost of service link between the supply cost and the actual Tier 1 rate. Why that is the Tier 1 portion, the cost of service foundation there is that we're giving the lowest cost source of supply to Tier 1 because it's developed to meet, you know, baseline health and human safety needs first and foremost. And so that's why we kind of took that away from indoor, because there wasn't enough of that groundwater available to meet all the budgeted indoor, but there was enough to meet 20% of the total budget. And that was essentially the rationale 5 years ago.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, if you go back and look at the Tier 1 rates back then, because of the indoor-outdoor, the Tier 1 rate was close to $1.80, and it actually had gone down to just a little over $1. So, you know, really trying to focus on that, matching the cost based on supply was really the focus, Director
okay.
Armstrong.
Thanks.
Okay. I want to just talk a little bit about how we actually calculate the supply portion of that layered tier rate I talked about? So for each of the there's five different sources of supply in that portfolio there. And so for each of those, we calculated how much does it cost to develop one unit of that water. So, for instance, groundwater costs approximately 76 cents per CCF, that's 100 cubic feet. Paris 2, $1.58, and so on. That just tells us the cost for that specific source. It doesn't tell us how much it would cost within the tier, right? So for the three different buckets of supply portfolio that we've grouped them under. So local supply is residential tier one. Blended supply is our non-tier customers, non-residential tier one customers, and all tier two residential and non-residential. And then imported supply is tiers three and four residential. So we calculate the weighted unit cost for each tier by calculating how much groundwater is available. So, for instance, in local supply, there's 5.6 million CCF available. So 76 cents times 5.6. Then we get to Paris 2, $1.58 times 2.2 million CCF. So to supply the 7.8 million CCF for Tier 1, it's about 99 cents per CCF. That's the weighted unit supply cost when you blend the groundwater and Paris 2. And so we did that same calculation for the other two columns as well. $3.11 weighted unit cost for the blended supply and $3.64 for the imported supply. So that's the supply that goes to tiers three and four strictly. Now I want to talk about the base extra capacity, specifically base max day, max hour. So if you're building, you know, if you're building the system from scratch, you're not going to build it to meet the average day demand, right? You're going to build it to meet the absolute highest demand plus some additional capacity to meet that period of demand. But, you know, that if we charged as if it was average day demand, we would under-collect. And so it's appropriate for us to look at first, what is the base demand and what are the costs associated with that? And then as we scale up the system capacity, how much of that's built for max day, how much of that's built for max hour on top of that, and to allocate the cost, essentially to allocate that white space, that unused capacity, to customers based on their usage. So after allocating the, you know, I mentioned things like storage and pumping, those are allocated to max day, max hour. Things like distribution are allocated to base max day. After we allocate all that infrastructure based on how it's designed and used in the system, we have a percent of the revenue requirements to each of those three components, and then we allocate it to the different rate classes. So this just illustrates residential, but then the non-residential has its own share as well. So for instance, residential has 77% of base, or 7.6 million, and across the tiers, that's 29 cents per unit. We allocate base to every unit of water. So on the figure on the bottom, you can see that tier 1, 2, 3, and 4 all have 29 cents. And then tiers 2, 3, and 4, they'll be allocated the max day because then they get to those higher usage amounts. And then lastly, tiers 3 and 4 are allocated the max hour component. So as I mentioned previously, conservation is weighted to the upper tiers. We have allocated that 30% of the cost associated with that program to residential tier 3 and non-residential tier 2, and then the remaining 70% to residential tier 4 and non-residential tier 3. And this is, you know, an estimate of where a lot of the focus for the conservation program has been, where it will be into the future. You know, if we're finding ourselves in another drought scenario, a lot of the conservation will be targeted at tier four and tier three. And so it's appropriate to allocate the large percentage of those costs to those tiers. And you can see that The Tier 3 share is 79 cents per CCF estimated, and the Tier 4 share is $6.03 per CCF. Just to bring all those components together, so I mentioned it is a layered approach, right? So we have the supply at the top, and then base, max day, max hour, and conservation. We are also including in Tier 4 the differential between met Tier 2 water and met Tier 1 water. The district, you know, does not currently purchase the Tier 2 water, but if Tier 4 water continues, the Tier 2 purchases, the differential there is an appropriate cost to include in Tier 4. You know, if all users use water at that level, the district over time, that portfolio could change.
Could I ask a question on this slide?
Yes, sir.
Sure.
Because, again, this may be a new way of thinking, but I'm looking at, so the overall change on Tier 1, which are the people that are doing their best to conserve water, we're going to go up and propose 9%. But Tier 4, the folks that are maybe not staying their water budget as much, seem to be getting a break. That seems to go against at least the 16 years I've been on the board here, the way we're doing things. So could you simplify that for me just so I can wrap my head around the fact that Tier 1's getting an increase and Tier 4 is getting a discount?
Yeah, it's a great question. So Tier 1, I can tell you the increase there is due to that higher supply cost, simply put. Because we have to blend in now Paris 2 water, the unit supply cost is going up, unfortunately. The benefit, though, is that we can maintain that 20%. And also, you know, we expect that the remainder of their budget, you know, if customers remain in budget, that Tier 2 impact should be minimal. So that, you know, that doesn't entirely offset it, but you know, it sort of does help. Regarding Tier 4, that is, you know, that is something that stood out to us as well. I think the fact is that with Tier 4, it is a small portion of the overall demand, and so subtle changes in the peaking factors, in the allocation of costs, they sort of get magnified because it is a smaller share of the overall total usage. And I think that explains or can be pointed to as a cause for some of that. And the changes in max day and max hour, I think, have come down a little bit as well.
So I guess, I mean, and you may not be the right person to ask this. It may be more of a question for our PGA group, but how do you explain this to customers? How do you explain this to in a press release that we're taking a Tier 1 folks that are doing the best to conserve and increasing their rates 9%, and the people that we used to call water wasters, I don't want to do that anymore, but we're giving them kind of a break from what they used to pay. What's the soundbite on that, I guess? And again, it may not be your duty to do that, but
Joe
looks eager to give me the soundbite on that.
I mean, President Paul, it's a great question, and we did debate this among staff. But as shown here on this slide, Tier 1 is still a third of Tier 2 and a sixth of Tier 3. So it is still our absolute lowest cost of water. The challenge for us was that if we strictly kept it as groundwater without the Paris desalter, it would not provide a meaningful percentage. It would be about 14%. So we felt that for Tier 1 to still be a meaningful amount of water, to get it up to the 20%, we had to augment strictly the wells, and that was a Paris 2. Now, Paris 2 is still lower than the Paris 1 in Manatee, primarily because of LRP funding for Metropolitan. That's why it's distinct. But to your point, the cost of local water has gone up, but it's still absolutely the lowest cost of water supply for our customers who do their best to be efficient. So to me, that would be how I would share this information. It's still about a fourth of Tier 2 and about a sixth of Tier 3. So it is absolutely our lowest cost of water that we are making available to our most efficient customers.
Okay.
Joe, if you went to the 14%,
yeah,
that rate then wouldn't have went up 9%.
That's correct.
But the tier two, the budgets would change, and people would go into tier two much quicker.
That plus tier two would go up slightly.
Right.
Because now you're – so, yes, you're right. 14% would be a condition whereby there would be more customers going into tier two, a lot more Porsche. So we wanted to keep it as a meaningful percentage. And that, and as I said, it was a dilemma because we debated this greatly internally to how do we keep it meaningful? How do we keep it the absolute lowest cost of water, knowing that by adding Paris 2, that there is an increase in their local water supply cost?
I think also this would potentially result still in, I mean, the overall increase would be much less than the 9% because most of their water is at the 0% increase. So overall, it's going to be, you know, down at 2 or 3% increase.
Yes,
overall.
Yes. You're kind of beating this to the punch, if you will, or getting ahead of us. But 80% of the water within an average customer, a residential customer's budget, which is tier two, would be at 0% increase. At least the tiered rates.
Right.
We haven't gotten to fixed charges yet. So you're right. It's, you know, if someone were to use 100%. Of their water budget, meaning all of Tier 1 and Tier 2, 80% of it would be a zero, 20% would have at Tier 1. Now, what we will, and again, not to get ahead of the presentation here, but we will come back at the next meeting and show you the bill impacts for an average customer that stays within their budget, customers that exceed their budget, or customers that are below budget. You know, that is going to be presented for you to get a sense of the impact on customers' bills. And frankly, then there's going to be scenarios that we're going to be sharing with this board as far as, you know, what approach do we want to take to adopt the new rate. So all of that is to come. I apologize. I probably got ahead of the presentation, but I did want to answer the question.
Okay. No, I mean, we'll go back on the presentation. I just wanted to point out that those percentage changes certainly stuck out to me as a board member that were a little – not how we've always been doing business here. So,
and I think
please continue.
Yeah, I just appreciate the comment and question because certainly this is the feedback we want to do so that when we bring back rates to you in March, we've, you know, at least addressed and can discuss your concerns. So,
okay,
Mark.
And I one last thing I just want to point to it on this as well is those tier four customers, they go through tier three before they get to tier four, and the tier three rate is going up. So there is some offset there as well. They are getting that impact while they're in tier three before they get to tier four.
Point taken.
So it's not totally off. They're not, you know, they're getting some impact. But I hear your observation, and we'll work on that. Okay, switching to non-residential, similar layout. So we have the supply tier, and then their share of base, max day, max hour, and conservation. So just kind of getting ahead of what I think will jump out is that the tiered non-residential customers, their rates are expected to decrease or stay flat in the case of tier three, while the non-tiered customers are projected to increase by a decent amount. So the main reason behind this shift is stemming from our 2018 cost of service analysis. When we developed the tiered, 2018 was the first year for non-residential tiered rates. And at the time, those rates were very much developed using data for landscape and irrigation non-residential customers. As you can imagine, those customers have a higher peaking profile than a domestic customer, domestic non-residential customers, such as, you know, a coffee shop or an office complex. As the district has developed budgets for those latter group of customers, that has resulted in what we're seeing here is sort of a flattening of that peak for those non-residential customers. And so we're moving customers from the non-tiered into the tiered in this analysis. And that is having the impact that you're seeing. So what's still in the non-tiered at this point are customers that that do have a peak profile that's closer in line with the tiered at this point. And so that's why you see that the tier one rate for non-residential is very close to the non-tiered rate, whereas previously the non-residential tier one was much higher than the non-tiered. And I just wanted to point that out while we're, you know, on this slide. Switching to fixed charges, so I mentioned there are three components to the fixed charge. There's first the customer service charge. Every customer, regardless of their meter size or usage, pays that amount, and right now that's about 16 cents per day. And that's, we estimate that's about 6.5% of the total allocation of costs. We recalculated that with the latest data, and it's just shy of 20 cents per day. So that's where we're seeing some increase there. Meter services, currently 34 cents, about 14% of costs. We're estimating that that is an increase of about 1 cent per day. And then lastly, the capital charge, which I think John might talk a little bit more about in a moment, is currently 18 cents, or about 9% of costs going forward. We are projecting an increase there, and that is in large part to bolster the district's R&R funding goals and repair and replacement of the system.
So just briefly,
go ahead, John. Sorry.
Just going back to Mark's comments. So the current capital charge of 18 includes an R&R component that, as the board is more than aware, was sort of approved as part of the last rate adjustment back in 2021. And if you recall at that board meeting, we certainly gave an update on our R&R planning model, what the anticipated costs would be in the future to maintain and to do the rehab and replacement of our system. So at that point, the board did approve for both water and sewer adjustments to the capital charge. I mean, we had this discussion about having a separate charge by itself for an R&R, ultimately just added it to the current capital charge. And so, you know, at least, you know, the last bullet is we at this point, at least recommend continuing that R&R charge and, if appropriate, increasing it. If you recall, certainly the need is more than what we currently are charging, and we want to build this reserve over time in order to, you know, to try to avoid those rate spikes. So we highlight if appropriate. I think going back and looking at the fixed charge increases and stuff, you know, do we continue to charge the R&R charge of the 4 and 3 cents, or do we reduce it for a couple of years and then reinstitute it or increase it in prior years? So as we refine the model, we'll be coming back to you in March with a recommendation to make sure that rates are you know, appropriate and reasonable as we go forward.
So can I jump in for a
second?
What would be the reason not to bring it up to what it is actually costing us to do the replacements? I mean, I think for the ratepayers, we need to be sharing with them, yes, we have all these costs are going up, and you need to participate in it, not have a false sense, and sometimes in the future we're going to have to really raise rates here.
Well, it's a great question, and Joe and I were discussing this yesterday, that, you know, the rates that you're seeing and the capital charge already includes a component to pay for our betterment and R&R every year. This additional amount is to build the reserve to pay for these costs that are going to occur in the future. As we Joe and I were talking, if the increases that we come back with are higher than what we're hoping to implement, we would recommend a use of a rate stabilization reserve. And so to us, we were discussing this aspect of, on one side, we're using a rate reserve to smooth or not to have as large of an increase, but still charging this other charge to build up another reserve. And so we had this discussion, does that really make sense? So from that aspect, I agree, President Pauly, we need to make sure customers are paying and that we're trying to fund those future costs. But if we have a high increase, we're going to come back with a recommendation to potentially use a rate stabilization or to reduce that reserve for a short period of time.
And President Pauly, we absolutely agree that we need to make certain that over the long term, this organization is setting aside appropriate reserves for rehabilitation and refurbishment of our facilities as we continue to invest in our infrastructure. That is a commitment this board has made over the years, and we will continue to do that. I think what we need to resolve is, as we look at the inflationary impacts that we're seeing on the water and sewer, and as we bring forward options for this board to consider, we're going to have to decide whether we want to consider utilizing rate stabilization fund, at least for the next couple of years. And if so, that's really the question that John and I were discussing. Do we, you know, dip into the rate stabilization fund while increasing our investment in the R&R reserve? It may be contradictory, but those are the kind of the discussions that we need to have with the board once we have, as I mentioned, additional scenarios and additional options that we can share with you.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
You need an ad valorem. That's what you need. But I don't know that you would ever get that passed.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dr. Curran. I don't think at this point it's a feasible option for us to consider.
All right, with this, we'll move on to the sewer. Mark?
Okay. So as we've discussed previously, the biggest item we're looking at on the sewer rates is this concept of postage stamp rates. And as you're familiar, postage stamp is one rate across the entire service area, integrating all the service areas, the subservice areas, under one rate, regardless of where they are, in contrast with the current five service area rates. And conceptually, you know, we see kind of three different policies in support of that. First is that the integration of the district's treatment facilities really does support a post-stamp consideration, and how flows can largely be moved throughout the service area. When the district established these rates, the current rates, that was not necessarily the case. And so with that change over time, and expected change over time, there's further support for postage stamp. The second is that recycled water on the other side of the sewer system is a system-wide asset. There's only, you know, one rate throughout the district. And so just to mirror that would be the postage stamp. And then lastly is just sort of a conceptual message that, you know, with one postage stamp rate, there's a reliable level of service communicated by that. You know, all the district's customers receive reliable sewer service today, but with a postage stamp rate, the rate structure would mirror that as well, that there's only, you know, one level of service. Just a brief note on the sewer rate history. So the cost of service study in 2009 established those five sewer service rates. And since that time, the rates have been increased by CPI annually. The block factors for residential, so where there's, you know, a 1-to-2-person household, 3-to-4, 5-to-6, and so on, that was implemented in 2012. And then in 2015, the district implemented a fixed charge for capital projects, which in itself is actually a postage stamp rate. There's only one sewer fixed charge for capital projects across the service area. John, did you want to add anything on this one?
Just, you know, going back to the history, the last time it was, you know, the rate was developed for cost of service was in 2009, and really just CPI increases since. And just, you know, I think going back to the proportional cost of based on the interrelation between each of the service areas, it does make sense to move forward with a postage stamp rate. So one of the things that we want to provide, you know, the board was sort of a little more history on just that, the aspect on the sewer rate. So certainly this just shows you how rates have changed over time. I mean, you can see in 2009 was the last internal cost of service study for a sewer. And then we really have adjusted it based on CPI since. Currently, to the side, you see Paris is at roughly $41 a month, while Hemet, San Jacinto are at $30. In this next slide, we wanted to ask staff to do a comparison to where we stand as far as our sewer rates in comparison to other agencies. So here you will see in the blue, those are the various service areas that we have with Hemet to the left, Moreno Valley, Sun City, Temecula, and Paris. And then we did survey and had staff look at rates for surrounding agencies as of January 1st. Those are the ones that are in the green. And as you can see, most of our, you know, at least four of our rates are really in the lower half. That red line represents what the postage, I mean, it's not perfect, but where the postage stamp would be, and that's that purple bar. So the purple EMWD postage stamp rate, if we had a postage stamp rate today, would be that. And so certainly you see Sun City, Moreno Valley, Hemet that are lower than the postage stamp. You see Temecula, that's slightly higher, and then Paris Valley, which is a few dollars higher than our current postage stamp. So we wanted to just give the board, you know, how do we compare where they sit in relation to other agencies, and then also if we had a postage stamp rate, where that would sit today in comparison to those five other service areas. Any questions on that? I think it's just helpful for the board to understand where, you know, certainly where our current rates sit in comparison to other agencies and also just in comparison to the different service areas.
And I think, John, what I would add is this is a legacy issue, and part of the challenge for us is the disparity between the service areas. For example, Sun City, as the board is aware, all that wastewater collected from that service area is conveyed up to the Paris plant. But yet the Sun City wastewater customers pay a lower cost than the Paris customers. So if we were to retain this structure, we would have to do an additional cost study to really support what we currently have in place, because right now there appears to be disparities. So that is where our recommendation is stemming from, is to move to a postage stamp rate over a number of years. We recognize that this is a transition, but ultimately if we can put ourselves on the path to that transition, we can be in a better place collectively.
Thank you, Joe. I'm going to move over to the preliminary sewer cost of service and turn this back over to Mark to go through at least the preliminary calculation, which, of course, will change as we get final budget numbers. Mark?
Yeah. So the cost of service is sort of how we get from from five rates to one rate. We wanted to estimate how much of the costs are associated with these four different functional categories: customer service, treatment, collection, and transmission. Not all customers benefit from these services. There are some areas that, you know, for instance, don't have collection from the district or customer service costs. So we did want to look at those separately, those four components. And the daily service charge, right now we're estimating, because of course there is no postage stamp rate, but if there was one in place currently based on the current level of revenues and the current number of connections, the postage stamp rate would be about $32.83 per month. And we are estimating that that would be $34.64 in 2024, of course, pending updates to the model. And the capital charge right now, when you add that in, the $3.64, that would bring the current estimated daily cost, or excuse me, monthly billing to $36.47, and the projected amount would be $39.64. Now, knowing that, you know, there is a gap between the five different service areas, we wanted to look at a phase-in option for the board to consider, so that the rate impact is not quite as steep for customers. So, you know, on the one hand, we want to achieve full revenue recovery. On the other hand, we want to mitigate the rate impacts. We don't want, you know, some groups of customers going up by a very large amount overnight. So we wanted to look at phase-in options. We have looked at anywhere from 5 to 10 years, but we are presenting the 7-year as sort of a middle of the road, and can modify it as needed. But we think 7-year kind of balances that timeline. And the objectives, I sort of already stated, but that we want to achieve revenue recovery but mitigate any 1-year, individual year impact. So just starting with that full postage stamp highlighted at the top, you can see if we went from the current estimated 3283 out to 2030 and 4560 per month, and then the starting point for each of the five service areas is in that row under 2023. And you can see we've in this option, we've kept individual one-year increases at 7% or below. So there's no individual year that's increasing by more than 7%. We can make modifications to this to better adjust, just keeping in mind that we do sort of have some constraints as far as revenue recovery and wanting to achieve that target.
Yeah, I just add, just looking at this and, just comparing in year 24, without the phase in, the overall increase in the system would be 5.6%. And talking about the phase in for Hemet, who's Hemet and Moreno Valley, would only see a 7% increase, which is less, less than 1.5% more than the other. So, knowing that they're, lower than the others, that increase will be between, 0.5%, 1.5% over that phase in period. So just really looking at the baseline of the 5.6, really they're going to be the additional 1.4% as an example for Hemet. So really trying to focus on, a phase in that won't have significant impacts on those service areas that are under the postage stamp, right?
And John, I would add, when we look at the anticipated increases on the postage stamp rate, 5.6%, 6.1% over the next couple of years, a lot of the significant escalations that we've seen in chemical cost that we use at the wastewater plants are incorporated in those estimates. So that, I know the board is very well aware, for example, the price of sodium hypochlorite has doubled, from $1 a gallon to $2 a gallon. Wastewater plants use chemicals extensively, and so what you see there is a reflection of the price escalations we've seen in chemicals and power and other commodities.
Can I ask you, Chris? So this is strictly operational costs, or is this operations and potential increases in sizes of the plant?
So
are we looking at future populations and how much we're going to have to put into the individual plants in the future, or is this strictly changes in operational costs?
Sure. No, that's a great question, Dr. Cornell. So primarily this is operational cost, and what I mean by that is capacity expansions at the treatment plants are primarily funded by the developers. Facility participation charges that will fund expansion. Now, we also have to rehabilitate, refurbish existing plant capacity. That's where the capital charge that comes in. That was shown earlier. It's not part of these numbers. It is a separate. But the numbers you're looking at right now is strictly operational cost.
Okay. Thank you.
So with that, maybe I'll just cover this, Mark. So this is our, our last slide, and just to talk about next steps. So certainly move forward with the current methodology that we are currently using. In February, I mentioned this earlier. We're expecting budget submittals in mid to late February. That information will be put into our system and ultimately provided to Mark to update the model. Based on that information we receive towards the end of February, we'll be returning back to the board. I think it's March 15th or mid-March, the second meeting in March, to provide you the preliminary rates, the bill, the bill impacts, recommendations if there is a need for use of rate stabilization or any other significant changes. We'll have some recommendations there based on feedback from the board. At that point, we'll come back a month later with the final report, with final proposed rates. And at that point, we'll ask the board to
at least approve the Prop 218 notice and for us to to notice the hearing that would happen in June. I will say the cost of service study will provide sort of that support to what we can justify on a cost basis. Ultimately, what the board will approve can certainly be less. And just to sort of reflect back on the 2017-18 study, when I go back and look at that, it had projected certain rates. The district has been able to keep the rates a little lower than that, and so we haven't always increased those rates at the max at the cost of service debt. So staff is very very aware of the inflationary environment, the fact that significant rate increases could have an impact on our customers, and we'll do our best to mitigate that within reason, but also being fiduciarily responsible. So with that, I think that's our last slide. Certainly appreciate the questions and thoughts and comments, and be open to any further questions.
So John, if I can add maybe one more thing for the board's consideration. The numbers shared today, as Mark and John mentioned, they're very preliminary. We're still working on them. This is still work in progress, but we wanted to at least share with the board the trajectory of where we're going. Well, one thing that I am pleased with is what the cost of service is showing is that because this organization has year after year done the appropriate adjustment to rates, we're not seeing double-digit offsets here. We're not seeing double-digit differentials, even in an unprecedented inflationary market. So I think the one of the takeaways for me is because this organization year after year has made nominal rate adjustments, we are actually in a fairly reasonable good place. There are options that we need to discuss. I think the point you brought up, President Pauly, about the Tier 1, that's a really excellent point that we're going to look at again. But overall, the team is not coming back to me and saying, "Oh, we were missing the mark by 10 or 20%." That's not the case here. There is some issues that we have to address, but overall, I think relatively speaking, given all the inflationary pressures we're seeing, we're in a better place than I expected.
Director Armstrong, you had a question or a point?
Well, I would comment and just tag on to what you just said. I think this definitely demonstrates what you've just described, and what's being proposed is just more good, sound financial planning, and it looks really good. The only comment I had was really about the block rate structure for the wastewater, and I think it's innovative, it's progressive, and it kind of helps address that inequity that happens with bigger homes and smaller homes, and so I think it's great that we have it, and I just want to put out again, I don't know if you've had a chance to, I know we have one area that doesn't implement those block rate structures because they're doing the billing for us.
Yes.
And I would just hope that we could try to reach out to them and try to encourage them to implement that for us.
No, that's a great point, Director Armstrong. And by the way, we didn't necessarily get into the block rate structure for the sewer here because our position is that we would maintain that. The rates that you saw here were for the full 100% rate,
right.
And obviously there's a sliding scale depending upon the number of occupants in the house. To your point, we are reaching out to our sub-agency to see if they can incorporate the sewer block rate. They're going through a upgrade of their financial system, and the initial response we received is once that's completed, they'll be able to accommodate our request. So we'll continue engaging with them and see if there's a way to move forward on that.
Any other comments? Or
not for me.
I just want to make one final point back to the R&R. I really just want to be upfront with our customers of yes, there's going to be some rate increase. It's what's happening in our society, I don't want to shield them from that. I think they will under. I think we have a very good team here of explaining things to our customers. So I don't want to defer maintenance cost or other replacement cost going forward just to not have to deal with it at the time. I think I'd rather kind of be upfront on those things now. So that's my final comment. Great job.
Appreciate
to the
it.
Team. Great job by our consultants on this. And I look forward to moving forward on it. So thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We will go to item Number six on our agenda, which is to receive and file various reports. Director Perrone, I'd like to make a motion on that. Director Slauson would like to second it. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0 with director record absent. That brings us to our calendar review. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. I have two events for your consideration. On Friday, January 27th, is the Southern California Water Coalition's quarterly luncheon. And on Wednesday, February 22nd, Western Municipal Water District is hosting the Citizens University Committee on Solving the Water Crisis with Craig Miller. The flyers for those events are located within your calendar packet. Turning to page 2 is the current listing of board members' master calendar for the next 2 weeks. Please review this information and let me know if anything needs to be updated or changed. On the top of page 3 are the upcoming conferences and events with participants. Tomorrow, January 19th, is the Inland Empire Utility Agency's California Water Supply Update with Metropolitan Chair Ortega. On January 27th is the Moreno Valley Chamber of Commerce Installation Award event. And Thursday, February 9th, is the Municipal Water District of Orange County's Water Policy Forum. And lastly, on March 4th through the 8th, is the Water Reuse Symposium. And all the information flyers are located at the back of your calendar packet. Continuing on page 3 is the board member and board committee meetings. Please note that February's administrative committee meeting has been rescheduled to Wednesday, February 9th at 7:30 in the morning. So continuing down is the rest of the meetings for March through March are on schedule. On page 4 is the interagency meetings. The Lake Elsinore meeting was rescheduled to next Monday, January 23rd. Otherwise, all other meetings through the month of March are on schedule. So EMWD's offices will be closed on Monday, February 20th. And are there any questions regarding the calendar review? That concludes my report. Thank
you. Very good. Thank you very much for that. We will go to board members' attendance reports, and we will start with Director Armstrong.
Yes. So actually, our general manager covered a lot already on the first part of the board meetings and committee meetings at MWD, but I would just like to say first thanks to Joe for coming down there and making the introduction. I appreciated that. It's quite an operation that they have in place there, and it's very welcoming and just really very supportive there, and so I'm really happy to be there and trying to participate. The installation event for the chair was really well done, and so that was all really good. There was another meeting yesterday where we had an update on the Colorado River, and so I just want to share that too, which sounds like there's a greater urgency now to come up with voluntary solution to cuts on the takes from the Colorado River. And the 7 states are back at it again, and the update is that they're working very cooperatively right now. They need to come up with a solution by the end of the month. And the new development, at least the new one that I've heard, is that there are concerns by the Bureau of Reclamation about Lake Powell and the level at Lake Powell and being able to operate the dam and cavitation and some other issues that may pose problems there. So if there isn't a solution, regardless of cuts, the Bureau of Reclamation may be stepping in just because of operational concerns that they have there as well. So this should all play out by summer, and they should have a direction on what's going to happen, you know, after that. And then the Joint Inland Orange County Caucus to review the upcoming board meeting at MET. And then the staff has been being very, very supportive and giving me volumes of information related to Metropolitan from financing and rates and water shortage contingency plan, administrative code, et cetera. So I appreciate that very much.
Very good. Thank you for that. Director Corona.
Okay, so the only meeting I had was the Rancho California Water District meeting, which was extremely short. I usually talk to them at public comment period, and After I spoke, they went into closed session for union negotiations for the next hour and a half, so I didn't hang around for the rest of it, and that's all I have.
Very good. As the general manager mentioned previously, we had a great meeting here with IE Works and hope to collaborate with them in the future. It fits right in with today about succession planning, workforce, and so looking forward to working with that group. I appreciate Joe hosting them here, and I had a follow-up conversation with their executive director, Scott Goodall. He said, "This what a class act we are here of all the agencies they interact with, that we are probably the class act of what they have seen." I had a good meeting with the general manager, and then last week I was able to attend with the general manager the dedication ceremonies honoring Lois Krieger and Director Don Galliano out at Lake Matthews. There's a whole new overlook honoring them. Director Record spoke, obviously a fantastic job. Director Denstedt for Western spoke, and also did a family job, great job. They had members of the families there for both the honorees. I thought it was a very quality event. I had actually never been on the property of Lake Matthews before, so that was interesting. I don't know if you had any follow-up comments.
No, I thought it was a wonderful event in the recognition of Lois Krieger, who was the first female chair of Metropolitan. Mm-hmm. The Water District, and of course, Director Galliano, who we all cherish. So I thought it was a very well done event, and thank you, President Pauly and Director Record, for participating in that.
Very good. With that, Director Slauson.
Yes, had our monthly meeting with Joe and discussed a number of issues, which helps prepare us for the meetings, and attended SOPI yesterday. We had the rotation of officers, increased compensation for the commissioners, and then recognized retiring general manager, Orange County Sands general manager, James Herbert. So he's well recognized in the community and a real leader. So that's it.
Very good. With that, director's comments or future agenda items? I had one. I'm going to pass these down, if you would be so kind. I saw it. There's an article in the San Francisco Chronicle the other day, and if you allow me, I just want to read the first two paragraphs very quickly. It says, in 2014, during the throes of last decade's drought, California voters approved billions of dollars for infrastructure which would catch and store much-needed water from winter storms, as we just had. This hope was to amass water in wet times and save it for dry times. Nearly 10 years later, none of the major storage projects, which include new and expanded reservoirs, have gotten off the ground. And again, I watched it rain the last couple of days here, knowing that a lot of this water is just washing out to the Pacific Ocean in the middle of a drought. And you know, California, I think last week at one time, we were in the middle of a drought and flood emergency all at the same time. This, to me, again, in 2014, 9 years ago, the voters of this state told the state, we want more water storage, and the state has done nothing. And I cannot control the state of California, but we can control what we do here. And so I just want to reemphasize that our working group with the other four agencies, in which we're looking at how to capture stormwater and some other innovative things, I want to make sure that we're pushing ahead on this, because while we can't control the state, we can control what we do locally. And I think we need to definitely look at some more opportunities here in Southwest Riverside County, so when we do have these rain events, we're not seeing it all go out to Pacific Ocean. So I applaud our staff for working on that. I applaud this board for putting the resources together with our other four sister agencies to make sure that we're moving forward on this, because I think it's important. And this article just caught my attention of the fact that we just cannot rely on the state of California to put programs, even after the voters have told them this is what we want to do. And I guess this morning, Steve, you mentioned to me there's kind of a similar article in the New York Times along these lines.
I'll forward that. I think it came in on, I think over the weekend, they had a piece about stormwater, you know, because of all the flooding and the precipitation we had. But they did a long piece on it. I'll forward that to Joe.
I appreciate it. But I just think we need to kind of pedal our bicycle here in Southwest Riverside County and make sure that in our future we do have storage capacity here. So I'll leave it at that. I understand we have a need for closed session, Mr. General Counsel.
We do with Mr. Chair, as identified item 9A on our agenda.
Very good. With that, why don't we switch over to closed session?
Go ahead, Stephen.
We're back in open session now. Mr. Legal Counsel, could you please report out on our closed session?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 546.8 to discuss real property acquisition. A report was given to the board and instruction was given to staff. No formal action was taken by the board. That concludes my closed session report.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until Wednesday, February 1st, 2023 at 9 a.m.
Thank you.